Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
As the races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at Keeneland, hour two, off of really a delightful visit from Costa Arenas. Earlier, Jeff Bloom joined us, and now we turn to the lawn, particularly, and a dominating invasion by Bally Doyle, by the Aidan O'Brien team, and also Godolphin and Charlie Appleby, who continues to maraud the Breeders' Cup for Godolphin. And to kind of tie it all together, after a whirlwind few weeks that included a trip to the Melbourne Cup and then a return to the U.S. before getting home, the one and only Nick Locke. Nick, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Great to talk to you.
Nick, I appreciate this, and thanks again for Friday. There it was, a broadcast day, and you still carved out a half hour for us, and everybody appreciates it. And it actually started on Friday when you said about meditate, I expect she'll win.
Yeah, well, I mean, she did, and did impressively. I'm not going to take the credit for it, Steve, because she was a favorite, and her chance was a pretty obvious one. But I was pleased to see her confirm what most of us in Europe knew, that she was right out of the top drawer in terms of our 2-year-old fillies, and that granted a fair wind, she ought to dominate that field. So it was, yeah, that was very pleasing in that respect.
We'll dive into the races, particularly the turf events, and with the largest amount of international participation. But Nick, an overview first about the 2 days, the themes, and how you viewed it. You got a lot of time after a weekend like that on the trip home? Some reflections overall?
Well, it wasn't lost on me. If we take the turf races first of all, I'm sure we'll come to Flightline in a bit, but if you take the turf races first of all, it wasn't lost on anyone. It certainly wasn't lost on me, having to do six interviews with only two sets of connections, that the small fry didn't really get a look in. And if we expected in the late 90s and just into the early noughties Godolphin to win important races at the Breeders' Cup, and then subsequent to that, in the early noughties, we expected Aidan O'Brien to win at least one, if not two, Breeders' Cup races on a card. Thereafter, it became a little more difficult for both operations. Godolphin really struggled for a number of years at the end of the noughties into the 2010s until Charlie Appleby came along. And Ballydoyle's operation was geared less towards, you know, targeting the Breeders' Cup quite so strategically and just getting a lot of horses there, whether it was necessarily the right event for them or not, and some of them maybe were less suitable for it. I think when you have both of these great superpowers operating at full tilt, as they were over the weekend, it is going to be very hard for anybody else to get a look in on the turf, or at least significantly harder for anyone else to get a look in on the turf. And that, of course, flies counter to what's been the prevailing orthodoxy in the last few years, which was that the American turf horses would get stronger and stronger relative to the Europeans, because so many well-bred horses and so many great pedigrees were being acquired at the Premier Bloodstock sales by Chad Brown and Brad Cox and others. Now, these things are cyclical. This may turn around again next year. But it was very striking that you had both Godolphin and Aidan O'Brien going at full tilt with hardly a disappointing runner between them. Even the ones that had lesser chances ran well. So it augurs very positively if you're talking about European number of winners in Breeders' Cups moving forward. Whether it augurs quite as positively for the competitiveness of those races, I'm not entirely sure.
Well, and on that topic, because that indeed has been kind of the refrain that we're hearing, which is, the American turf horses are a lesser lot. There's probably a few things at work here. But, I mean, let's go through the races and maybe we can address certain things, because it's not as if the obvious dominant potential favorite in these races among among the non-North American participants, it's not like they all they all won. I mean, and we could start with the juvenile turf sprint, actually, because here was Platinum Queen, who was basically leaving her race in the paddock and on the racetrack. She was a absolute mess before they ever even got to the gate. And instead, here's Appleby with Mischief Magic, who really was good. I mean, just under 7-1, and dramatized. I thought was terrific.
Yeah, I mean, Mischief Magic didn't surprise me. Persian Force was the horse I liked going into the race. He ran well and had a very wide trip, but Mischief Magic actually benefited, I think, from slightly missing the break and there just being a burn-up on the front end. Yeah, Charlie always said he was a talented horse, and he actually just found the right stage on which to shine. The Platinum Queen, I hated her from that draw, and I think, notwithstanding what she did before the race, I think getting lit up with all that pace to the outside, there was only one way she could really be ridden. So, I think she was always up against it from out there. And dramatized, fair play to Carl Burke for getting her in the race and having a go in the end. I know it was open to some doubt, and she showed all the ability that she'd shown in the Queen Mary early in the season. And she'll remain quite a force, I think. But Mischief Magic could be a, if they keep him to sprinting distances, he could be a really, really good horse next year.
Well, and part of this story also included William Buick, who really put on a show.
Well, I mean, he did. I mean, you could argue, You could argue that he might have had four winners if the cards had fallen slightly differently for him, because Silver Knot was no doubt unlucky not to win the Juvenile Turf, I think, and Creative Force, probably the architect of his own downfall insofar as that he didn't quite have that pace to get in the holes he wanted to. He should have got in the turf sprint, but he finished off with a rare rattle, and he certainly was of comparable quality to, you know, anything that did fight out the finish in that race. So, yeah, Charlie Appleby's now won six of his last eight Breeders' Cup winning opportunities, and the other two could have gone his way, but for a different set of circumstances, which is pretty extraordinary.
You know, one thing we should also include in all of this is that had Blackbeard come, he probably wins this, right?
Maybe. I mean, I know Mischief Magic finished behind him at Newmarket. I think Blackbeard got a very good ride in the middle park, and yeah, who knows whether Blackbeard's slightly weird temperament antics would have got the better of him at a Breeders' Cup. So I don't know. I mean, it's on a strict reading of form, then yes, but I think Mischief Magic was just primed to peak at the right time, and he was the right sort of horse for the right race at the right time.
Well, for Meditate, the No Nay Never filly, and on what, some of our analysis that came through our show, you know, talked about how, you know, how successful No Nay Never, how the progeny have really been, you know, terrific, and here's Meditate coming through as the short price favorite. I mean, it was always clear that, you know, that she was going to go favored, and she really was dominant in here. And I know, you know, I talked to Shug McGahee after the race, and Shug was delighted with the second. And he thought that Pleasant Passage might have made this a little closer had she not gotten caught up a little bit here and there. But he, you know, he absolutely acknowledged the best horse won this race. You know, best coming in, best coming out.
Yeah, but given the hands that Pleasant Passage is in, I mean, that's an encouraging rug. You think that she could,
yeah,
she could take a big step forward next year, and, you know, under that tutelage, hopefully she will be a US-based turf filly to keep an eye on. Meditate's a genuine guinea filly, there's no doubt about that. I mean, she was a genuine guinea filly going into the race. I mean, I think she's probably not had to improve that much on her two most recent runs in defeat, for which, both of which there were sort of reasons to think that she could have done better, granted different circumstances. So yeah, she pays a very handsome compliment to Kazoo, who beat her in the Cheveley Park. She pays a handsome compliment to the filly who beat her in Ireland, particularly to Tahira, who's a sister to Tanawa. You'll be hearing plenty more about her. And she herself, because Aidan O'Brien has got such a brilliant record of getting horses right and ready for the first Saturday in May, she herself will be a formidable opponent for anyone when she turns up at Newmarket, which is what she will do.
We should mention, before we talk about the boys' race as well, Nick, Midnight Mile, who we talked about, the other No Nay Never filly in here for Richard Fahey, and ran a very credible race in here in a third career start, was giving away tons of experience, you know, schleps across the ocean, and was very good, was fourth in here, beaten three lengths for second and five lengths for everything.
Yeah, that was a good run, very limited experience, big gap between her first and second runs. If she took it all, she's got the pedigree to be good. And again, no reason why she shouldn't end up in a guineas. I'd imagine they'll start her off in a trial beginning of next season. She's got proven form at Newmarket on the Rowley Mile. I guess that's where she'll end up. And yeah, you're right. She's a high-class filly.
Turning to Victoria Road and Silver Knot, and what did you see, Nick, in here? Those that, you know, believed in Victoria Road got a nice $13 and change. Silver Knot off at 3-2, and like you said, maybe a little unlucky not to win this.
I think so. Yeah, I think Silver Knot probably should have won. He just got just a tiny bit more held up in his run as William Buick tried to burrow his way up the inside fence. And Ryan Moore, beautiful ride, saved ground and then tipped out and had a lovely run down the outside. Ryan said that when Victoria Road just came off a true line, he gave Silver Knot a chance, and otherwise he would have won more decisively. And that is true, But having said that, I think had Silver not started his forward momentum at the same time as Victoria Road, then he probably would have won. The two nice colts, I think Silver not shaped like slightly better of the two, and I'd be surprised if he wasn't the better of the pair next season. Having said that, Victoria Road remains lightly raced and promising. He's still improving, and he's got an excellent pedigree. I was talking to his breeder, Trevor Stewart, on my podcast this morning, and it's an amazing story. He bought the Grand Am for $80,000 as a foal back in the mid-90s, and he wanted a really nice one. I mean, you're spending a lot of money buying a foal for $80,000 in the mid-90s, filly foal, but the dynasty that she's produced is nothing short of remarkable. This horse and Auguste Rodin, two of the best juveniles in Ballydoyle,
wow,
both descending from the same Grand Am, and you know, the one out of Halfway to Heaven, who's also produced Magical, and you know, Magical's daughter, Magical's sister Rhododendron, producing Auguste Rodin, and then the other half sister Tickle Pink, also out of Cassandra Go, producing Victoria Road. So it's an absolute galaxy of stars just out of the one pedigree. So he's got the breeding to keep doing better, but and it's a very important win for Coolmore because he's a grade one winner by Saxon Warrior and freshman sire, so that'll not be lost on them.
Well, and this is now, I think, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it isn't, I was going to say, let's see, this is one, two, Donna Tevum pounced. Wrote George Vancouver, Hit It a Bomb, Mendelssohn, Modern Games, and now Victoria Road. So you know, the win in the Philly, you know, the Philly had been the province of North American interest for the most part, and with only two previous Invaders winning, but the boys' race. Now a clear lead, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 winners among European Invaders, and 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So the Euros now tipping the scales when it comes to the juvenile turf. That gets us to Saturday, and there weren't a lot of people celebrating the $87 win of Caravelle, but by the time we got through with the turf, Nick, later in the day, we were all, I think, a little thankful that Caravelle held up for North American interests, holding off Emiratiana, Creative Force, and Highfield Princess, the only North American-based winner of a turf race over the weekend.
Yeah, and I kept thinking to myself, how would this race have been different if Golden Powell hadn't missed the break? And the answer is very, I think. I mean, Caravelle got a nice ride on the front end. They didn't go mad for a turf sprint. And there were quite a few of them keen in the early stages, and the race didn't really get cut open like everybody anticipated. And I suspect that you know, whilst clearly Golden Pal did his own chances no favour, and you knew once he missed the break he was a busted flush, but I don't think that really did one or two others any favours either. I certainly think it inconvenienced Highfield Princess. I can almost see Jason Hart thinking, where are you, what's happening, and do I and then in the dilemma, right, well, do I go forward then, or do I try and wait for someone to give me a lead, and I wonder if he wishes he had gone forward. I don't know. Anyway, Golden Pal not kind of completely slicing the race open meant that Caravelle could sit and dominate, really, and Emiratiana got that lovely slot up the inside that everybody else wanted. Creative Force wanted it, couldn't get it. Highfield Princess was one further out, so couldn't get it. And that was the perfect sit, and got a lovely ride from Ryan Moore and nearly pulled off a beautiful result for me and several others. It's 42-1 on the tote board as they went in, and he returned about 18, I think, Emiratiana. But Caravelle just was too good and too dominant. I think it was a two-horse race from the outset, but not the two horses we expected. But the way the race panned out, there were only two horses who could ever win it, which were the first and the second. The Creative Force rattled home, but the race hadn't been hard enough and didn't collapse for him. And as I say, I think Highfield Princess could have done with Golden Pal actually breaking and going really, really hard, and then sitting in sort of second spot, and the rest of the field sort of struggling to go the pace.
Have you seen, I'll be remiss, I didn't get to it yesterday, but, you know, when digesting all the, you know, all the sort of inside baseball type stories, one of the things that had on video caught was Golden Pal seemingly held up slightly in the gate on the break with the starter and the starter's hand that seemed to, you know, stay on the bridle a little, you know, a little longer than is ideal. And I know that the coverage crew, you know, kind of watched it a few times and remarked on it. You know, some people wondering if there was a chance to have him considered a non-starter, but it you know, it was part of that story that, you know, that really, you know, hasn't been all that widely considered. I mean, we just have been sort of saying, you know, Golden Pal got away poorly, and, you know, there is that little sidebar. One thing about the way in which Arad dealt with it at that point, though, Nick, Golden Pal comes basically ranging up the inside, and I'm not sure why Ortiz felt compelled to then try to rate at that point. I mean, the only way Golden Pal was winning was to engage, and I don't know why he sort of begged off after making up that early ground.
No, I mean, I'd have to... I'm just actually having a look at the replay of this now.
Yeah.
As you're talking about it. Yeah, the staff has clearly got hold of his left rein.
Yeah.
He's come out of the stalls, which has not helped him.
Yeah.
And did he, I'm just trying to think. He then appeared to have a... I'm watching this again now, Steve.
Yeah.
He appears to then... Right, here he is. Sorry, this is making terrible radio.
No, it's fine. People want...
He virtually had hold of his bit as he came out, didn't he?
Yeah.
And then there was a gap appeared for him between creative force and the eventual winner, and instead of driving him in there, he just took it back a little bit. Yeah, I have no idea why he decided to do that.
Because,
I'm looking at the side on there.
Right, because at that point you're within striking distance of engaging, and that was your only chance to win. You're not going to win raiding Golden Pal at that point. Certainly, it was odd. This was one of those exasperating, you know, for whether you believed in Golden Pal or whether you just wanted Golden Pal to, you know, to prompt the pace and set things up for somebody to come, you know, from mid-pack or behind. This was one of those Breeders' Cup results that it's not inexplicable, but it is confounding.
Yes. Yes, it is true.
Well, let's get to one of our favorite results of the day, because Tuesday, not the 10:38 was some fabulous mutual, but Tuesday just... As we discussed on Friday, Nick, she just felt like the right horse in the right race at the right time.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing that we managed to call right here was that in Italian it was not going to get quite the soft time of it that she might have done, because Toy was in there to make sure in Italian was kept honest, and she was kept honest. And I thought In Italian ran a fantastic race in the circumstances. I really did. Because if she really had been able to toodle along the way she wanted to, it would have taken a titanic effort for Tuesday to get by her. And just that little bit of softening up, I think it enabled the result. Lovely ride again from Aidan O'Brien on the winner, but certainly Toy played her part. As I say, great run from the runner-up in the circumstances. And particularly if, you know, Chad Brown had a winner and he had horses run with credit, but he wasn't a full-on Chad Brown tinging, zinging everyone hitting the target for. So you'd think that in Italian will be formidable if she sticks around. I don't know whether she is staying in training or not. As for Nashua, it rather panned out as I expected it might do for her, because I think she's best when she's allowed to use her stride and that sort of natural energy of hers is not being too restrained. But sensibly enough, Holly Doyle didn't want to get drawn into the early skirmishes, and I think had she done so, she would have compromised herself even more. So she had to wait that little bit. I don't think she loved the track. It just took a while for her to get organised coming off the second bend. And to my mind, she's actually run reasonably creditably. That's not the best of her. I think you'll see the real Nashuara again in Europe next year.
The disappointment to some degree, particularly given the pace, would be Above the Curve, who really never put in much of an effort. I will acknowledge one thing about Tuesday that I haven't seen mentioned, is that this is a retribution, or however you want to characterize it, for her dam, Lily Langtry, who failed at 3-2, you know, 15 years ago, right, when she came for the Juvenile Fillies turf and was vanquished by Tappet's Fly for Dale Romans. But Lily Langtry's daughter gets her into the annals of Breeders' Cup success.
Yeah, she's a good filly too. You know, she won the Oaks, and she's followed it up with victory in a Breeders' Cup. There aren't many who do that.
Well, the mile, as anticipated as it was, and all the different ways, Nick, we were trying to find alternatives to modern games coming back again, and letting everybody open up the puns about cashing tickets. There was no withstanding modern games in this spot, but this was a really interesting race with all kinds of fascinating trips, and I am anxious to hear your take on what transpired here.
I thought he was 5 minutes the best, to be honest. But I didn't think he had a great trip, and the way he came barreling down the outside was really, really impressive, and ended up winning going away. And I would conjecture that any normal horse wouldn't have won that race, because you look at his form cycle, he was absolutely brilliant in Woodbine. I mean, that was a sparkling performance. He
yep.
smashed up Ivar and all the others by half the track.
Yep.
Now, you'd expect a horse having to travel back up reasonably quickly at Ascot, maybe not to be at his best at Ascot. And I don't think he was quite at his best at Ascot, but he still ran with great heart and courage in defeat. And then to come back off that and do what he did on Saturday, he is one hell of a horse. Yeah, if he peaked on Saturday, then I think he'd have won by daylight. Ivar's run another great race, particularly given that, you know, he's very effective at Keeneland, so he provides us with a pretty good yardstick. And yeah, Kinross was a bit unlucky not to finish a bit closer, but just a little, I think.
There were a few things happening behind. Cheryl Spite, who is another story about Keeneland and the course, and horses that like it really like it, horses that don't really don't. A very good second in here, and probably even at 55-1, there might be a scenario or two if they ran this race 100 times that Cheryl Spite wins. Kinross, I thought, ran very well, and to not much mention. Ivar fourth in here, kind of a one-paced effort. The horse that I'm going to nick, I mean, Andy Serling will get mad at me when I do this, but the best idea I had, and I cashed some tickets, but the best idea I had on the weekend was betting Malavath. And if she's not bouncing around in the gate before it opens and then loses God knows how many lengths in the first few jumps, all I needed her to be was third at 52-1. I mean, there's a scenario, Nick, where she impacts this race. I mean, she got beat, three lengths for everything, not even, 2.5 lengths.
And, yeah, there's a lot of scenarios where a lot of them could have been done a little bit better. I mean, Kinross is definitely one. Malavath is almost certainly another. But, Steve, go back and watch the race again and tell me that Modern Games wasn't a million times the best.
I don't know. I've been ugh about him all. I don't know. All year long, I've sort of had this this sour taste for some reason with him. But I can tell you this.
Listen, you're gonna be able to enjoy it again, I think, because I suspect he'll be back next year.
Oh boy!
I suspect he'll be back next year. This is the other thing about this Appleby domination and O'Brien getting his 2-year-old firing this year is that let's go through them. Victoria Road, he's not going to be amongst the best European 3-year-olds next year. You can bet your bottom dollar he'll be back at a Breeders' Cup if he's sound. Meditate, she'll be amongst the best European 3-year-olds of next year. What's to stop them taking her to Santa Anita if she's sound? Mischief Magic, well, he'll be 4-5 for the turf sprint next year if he stays sound. Tuesday, staying in training. Rebel's Romance will stay in training. And your man, Modern Games, in any normal year, you think, well, that'll do. We'll retire him. But they've got so many of these Dubawis at stud.
Amazing.
They're doing well. They don't need to ship him in yet. So it could be that all six Breeders' Cup winners from Europe return next year. That's a terrifying thought if you're, and don't forget of all the others that they've got coming along as well, and the ones that weren't there. As I say, this domination is not going to lessen anytime soon.
Mm. Well, I will say that Malvath now has acquitted herself beautifully as a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old in this event, and the Graffard team, I mean, they were delighted with her effort.
Yeah, of course, because, you know, she's become an even more valuable proposition, even though, you know, she's not got more black ties, she's enhanced her reputation. So, yeah, it was well worth the trip, and she's very good. And I thought it was a decent addition of the race. And as I say, I think first, second, and third, and fourth will probably all be back again next year.
How about what's the future for Order of Australia, who did not run badly, by the way?
Oh, and him probably. I don't know. They tried to retire him to stud at the beginning of the year, didn't they? Because he got that injury in the Coolmore Mile in 2021. Where he got a fracture, but then it was actually not as bad as was first feared, and they brought him back into training. And he's run a number of creditable races in defeat. It's difficult quite to see where the slots are for him, because he's just going to have to keep knocking heads against the same horses in the same races. So for him, I would think if somebody came in with a little stud offer from abroad, maybe that would be the ticket, or they just keep bashing away, I guess.
Well, in the same way that the conversation about Above the Curve and Nashua and Tuesday in the filly and mare turf, Rebel's Romance and Stone Age, the 4 and 3 respectively, and Nation's Pride as well, they were the same mojo types going into the turf, Nick, and then there was, you know, the more veteran Mishriff and some other players, but it did feel like, you know, the younger horses had the biggest, you know, had the biggest opportunities in this spot, and Rebel's Romance was just terrific.
Yeah, and I suppose two things: one, Rebel's Romance was impressive, and secondly, at least he was a horse that we hadn't got to the bottom of, but at least he was a horse who, no, we didn't quite know how good he was, and he could yet get better still. And I think that's probably the encouraging thing. I don't think it was a vintage running of the race.
No, it wasn't
a vintage running of the race. But the horse who won it is very good and has once again shown us not to underestimate form of German Group 1 races. Torquato Tasso, Alpinista, and now this horse have all shown us that you can use German Group 1s en route to winning some of the world's biggest horse races. So let us not be fooled by that next year. He's really good, and he's a huge monster of a horse as well. Huge, great hulk of a horse, Rebel's Romance. I wonder with him whether whether Santa Anita, for example, if you're looking at the title defense, would be the right track for him. I suspect it probably wouldn't, but I suppose what's exciting is what he might do between now and then, and whether he's good enough to take high order in the best mile and a half, mile and a quarter races in Europe next year, which is what he's going to have to do.
Well, I mean, he has now won five straight races at 12 furlongs. I mean, he's won five straight mile and a half events.
But the question is, right, is he going to be good enough to win an Eclipse, a Prince of Wales's, a King George, a John Lott International, those sort of races? If he was mine, just looking at the size of him and just the way he gallops, I'd be tempted to be targeting a race like the Judmont International. I can't see them wanting to run a horse like that, say, round Epsom in the Coronation Cup. The Ascot Straight's going to be short enough for him. I would have thought races like the Judmont might be right up his street.
Well, in retrospect, the 6-1 was a very attractive price because Warlike Goddess went off at 7-2, Mishriff went off at 9-2, Nation's Pride 3-1. So that $1,392 will spend well and point well down.
I don't think this is a difficult race to read, Steve.
Yeah.
Insofar as Stone Age and Nation's Pride were very closely matched horses. Nation's Pride got a pretty crappy trip and would have finished upside Stone Age. I mean, there's a cigarette paper between them on running and ability, I think. They're probably both horses, Nation's Pride and Stone Age, that don't quite stay a mile and a half really strongly. Like, they both win a mile and a half race, but they don't really get it strongly. The winner is a strong stayer and an improver, and came into the race in great form. Mishra's gone. Now, I mean, he's off to stud now anyway, but I think you only have to look at him before the race. He was a muck sweat. I did a piece on NBC about him. He'd been taken away from the rest of the field. He was being walked around under a tree. He was getting himself in a right stew. His mind is on other things now. He is mentally divorced from the game halfway through this season, I reckon. And just he's not as good as he was. And the rest of them were exposed as not good enough. And that is, I think, some people might think a bit reductive, but that would be a fairly straightforward reading of the race.
Before we ask for your take on the classic performance and Flightline's place in history, Nick, I do want to make one point about Rebel's Romance, who's now 9-12, and he's a gelding, so we're going to see him in North America at some point, Santa Anita notwithstanding. This, since the beginning of his career, and he won upon debut at Newcastle, he has won, those nine races have come at eight different racetracks. He's won at Newcastle, at Kempton, at Maidan, Newmarket, Goodwood, Hopgarden, and Köln, and now at Keeneland. This is a really, really cool horse that is going to be fun to keep track of. I think people who cash tickets on him, Nick, this is the kind of horse that when they go back to their international campaigning, American audiences will follow.
Here we go. So here's one for you with this horse. Given that he started his career by winning a UAE 2000 Guineas on the dirt, then he bombed out on the dirt when they brought him back. Now, was that because he didn't like the dirt, or was that just because he was in bad form at the time, or he was nursing an injury, or he needed gelding or whatever? Okay, so now they've got him rocking and rolling again. I tell you what, he looks like a dirt horse. He does not look like a turf horse. He's a great hulk of a thing. And Duvali have got a great record on the dirt. What price he's in the Breeders' Cup Classic next year, given my concerns about the turf track at Santa Anita, and given the fact that Charlie Appleby said, maybe I was wrong to be training him as a dirt horse, but then I looked at him train on the dirt earlier this week and thought I half fancy giving that a try again. What chances, with no flight line and sadly no epicenter and no life is good and all sorts of others who are off the stud, what chance Rebel's Romance pops up in the Classic in 12 months' time?
I love it. Why not? That would be that would be new and fresh and different. A opportunity for a horse to be a Breeders' Cup Turf and Classic winner. That'd be unbelievable.
Again, going back to the golden age of the sort of boutique Godolphin at the end of the 90s, when there was that year when Saki and Fantastic Light came over, Belmont Park in 2001, the post 9/11 Breeders' Cup, when they both got entered in both races, and they left it until the day before or whatever, or 2 days before, to decide which one was going to run in which. And they put Fantastic Light in the turf, and he won, and Saki in the classic, and he should have won.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's right. That's right. Well, there's a storyline to start the tab going into 2023. And since you gave a survey of potential returning classic types, Nick, you've been coming over here long enough, and you've covered plenty of Dubai World Cups as well. How does this horse compare historically, and what was your assessment of what we saw 72 hours ago?
Well, I think in terms, if you aggregate those last three runs, I think you'd be hard pushed not to argue that he's the best dirt horse in my lifetime. Just for the avoidance of any doubt, Secretary Hamp predates my lifetime. Just for anyone shouting that at the radio now, to do what he did off those fractions was nothing short of extraordinary. And the way the race opened up was incredibly absorbing, as only dirt races at that level can be. Is it entirely satisfactory when assessing a horse's whole body of work that he didn't really show up until he was four in earnest, anyway, in earnest, and then he was retired at the end of his four-year-old career after the end of six starts? It's, you know, in terms of a fan engagement situation, that is suboptimal. But if we're being asked to judge him on his merits, there is sufficient evidence to make the claim that he is the best in a generation, at least, and he should be celebrated as such.
How do you interpret the complaint? Because it is a complaint about the limited nature of. Mm-hmm. This career, we've gone out of our way in yesterday's show and today with Costa as well, but with John Sadler and David and Gordo, to flesh out the why and wherefore of the six starts. There were all kinds of reasons that contributed to, you know, the stunted style of the two seasons, the delay as well of the start of his career. So, you know, it to me, one of the positives actually is what a statement it is about the horse and about Sadler from a horsemanship standpoint, that every time this horse had to come off a layoff, he was ready to not just perform, but to drown everybody that showed up. And so really, if you want to make the case that, oh, he didn't run enough, well, okay. Even without being able to be in a form cycle and run on a regular basis, he killed everybody.
Exactly. And that's why if you're asking me to assess him on his merits and asking me about the his pure quality as a racehorse, then I'm quite happy to sit here and praise him to the skies. I think there is enough evidence. If he was a one-hit wonder, if he had produced one startling piece of form that you could rate off the charts, that was entirely not in keeping with the rest of his runs or his work cut or whatever, then you'd say, well, I don't know about that. You know, it was just a given moment in time or a crazy weird set of circumstances that enabled him to do that. But that hasn't been the case. And, you know, he traveled across the country to the Met Mile and absolutely dismissed a really, really high-class field. And I've seen Speaker's Corner a couple of times down in Florida and thought, oi, this is a bit special. Well, he got made to look like a pedestrian by Flightline. And given the Flightline's pedigree, you knew he should be better at a mile and a quarter, really, and so it proved. And I think horses who can show that much speed and sustain it are so rare, especially now. You know, there's two things that we complain about now, is that horses are being pushed too early, and they're sort of overbred for precocity, and that they don't stay. Well, neither was true in this case, but of course his greatest blessings became a bit of a curse because he's made himself so valuable and he's already four in such a light career that Connection has got their backs against a wall, really. You know, to show me anyone who'll say, well, yeah, this horse is worth over $150 million in all likelihood, but we're going to crack on and race it. And the irony of it is, you do wonder whether the old Pegasus, you know, the one that existed for about 3 years or 2 years, when there was $12 million on the table, whether they might have had one more dart and taken the money and then said, let's go to stud. But given that it is significantly less valuable now, albeit still, whatever it is, still $3 million, the incentive isn't quite there. And I did say, I mean, Mike Rapoli likes to put oil in the water and was doing so very engagingly at the back end of last week, but he did make a quite interesting point that the only incentive really for the horse to stay in training from a financial point of view was to go and run in the big money races in the Middle East, the Saudi Cup and the Dubai World Cup. And then, you know, at least you've paid off your insurance premium and you've stuck another $30 million in your pocket or the guts of. But as Mike said, if there were those races to be running for in America worth that kind of crazy cash, then maybe that would have incentivized them to keep him in training, but there aren't. So what were they realistically supposed to do? This is where when you do have a consortium of owners, I think it actually makes it more difficult to make this decision because if it was just a single owner who just happened to be a great sports fan and said, well, to hell with it, I'm not interested in breeding anyway and I've got so much money, what's it to me? I'll just carry on and take the risk. Then, you know, you might have had half a chance of that happening, but when there's multiple concerns, that's going to be an awful lot more difficult. Now, whether you can extrapolate from a share of him, a 2.5% share of him being worth $4.6 million, whether you can extrapolate that to his true value is a moot point, I think. But what it might do, that sale last night, is it may well have a hidden effect on what his stud fee is going to be.
Agreed, and we anticipated some of that yesterday with Sid's explanation of what was transpiring, and you know then there's frankly the unique nature of this opportunity, and you know there was anticipation. I happened to have been on Sunday night with our friend Will Schwartz and his son Drew. You know that are building a broodmare band and mainline racing, and they had said that in conversation with you know other industry stakeholders Saturday that somebody very prominent who I will not name suggested that this would sell north of $4 million just because of you know the premium unique. Opportunity and sure enough, I mean, when an individual outbids Coolmore, that is saying something. And so, you know,
one of the things is we don't know who the individual or individuals were, and there's no doubt though there were 45 pre-vetted interested parties who had a sufficient credit line to be considered for bidding. They had to be pre-vetted by the sales house, and you know, by the vendors beforehand. So if there were 45 interested parties who knew they could, who had sort of credits to the tune of, say, 2 million plus beforehand, that's an awful lot of people with a, not just an interest in the horse, but I would say from that community, a vested interest in the horse making a lot of money, because if you're in the stallion business, you want to see that share going for as much as it possibly can, because it puts a whacking value on the horse. Now, if he stands for $200,000 and covers 200 mares a year, you're going to get that money back within 4.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So then it doesn't seem such a crazy price. But if he's standing only, and I say only advisedly, for 100 or 125, then that calculation is vastly different. If you're there putting a value, effectively putting a value on him, I think a stud fee value on him of in excess of $200,000. And that's what Pharaoh stood for in his first year, and what a Justify stood for 150, didn't he? And they were taking 200 plus mares to them. So it's not wild to think it's going to be over $200,000. Now, if it is, then if you're retiring a slightly lesser horse to the stud, say a Life Is Good or whatever, and you're intending to go X, then perhaps you might then be encouraged to go X plus 15%. I mean, See the Stars, for example, his stud fee's been announced today. Big increase off the back of Baid. He's up 185 euros. And Baid himself has retired the stud today at 80,000 sterling. So recession may be on its way, and calls for stallion fees to come down may have been growing. But at the very top end, at the elite level, with the yearling sales incredibly buoyant, and given what happened yesterday, and with an exceptional group of horses this year, really exceptional group of horses in terms of pedigree and performance retiring to stud, I would suggest that the top end of the stallion market is only going to be dragged upwards in terms of price.
Well, and you know, part of this as well, and when it came to Justify, there was the proviso or the addendum that, of course, Scat Daddy had died prematurely, and with this horse, the fact that Tappet, you know, is not in his dotage, but he's on the other side of midnight, so being Tappet's best son counts for something as well. I mean, he's got everything going for him, this horse, heading into the market.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He's got the Holy Trinity, hasn't he? he's got the Holy Trinity. Looks pedigree performance.
As does Nick Luck.
Well, hang on. I'm not even sure I could claim two out of those three, but...
The absolute greatest. Nick, thank you for this hour. A perfect way to tie up that portion of the cup, because yesterday we were more on the main track. So I count on you for these, and you never let us down and our listeners down. And brilliant work given the globe-trotting fortnight that you've endured.
It's been crazy, but so much fun. Steve, thanks so much.
Nick Luck, and of course, Nick Luck's daily show as well. You can listen in, and there is just nobody like him, the world's greatest presenter. Let's take our second break of the morning. Andy Serling is going to join us next. John Green at the bottom of the hour as well. Second day of recapping. We're live at Keeneland. Today, actually, I'm back in the main building. Because, of course, the sale where I was yesterday, the sale press box, since they were starting at 10, I couldn't sit there and yammer for 3 hours with everybody working. It wasn't as intrusive yesterday. So I'm back over on the racetrack side, and most of our guests were going to be reachable by phone. Tomorrow, I think we'll be back over on that side. And expect a Garrett O'Rourke live visit, as well as one with John Sikora live as well tomorrow. I got to fill this in now. We will not be live on Friday. I'm going to try to make some other arrangements. We've had a family passing, and I will have to go Thursday afternoon to Florida and be on hand for a funeral on Friday. So we're going to going to broadcast from Churchill on Thursday, and in anticipation, actually, of claiming crown Saturday at Churchill Downs. And then I'll fly out of Louisville and fly back to Louisville and head home. But kind of an interrupted or kind of a little bit of a detour here at the end of this trip. So back at Keeneland tomorrow, Churchill on Thursday, and probably either a best of or I got something I'll see if I can't make happen for you on Friday. Back after this, though, Andy Serling joins us from the New York Racing Association. Hour three at the races. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? The University of Arizona's race